The short story, The Move. The day the moving van arrived to cart our possessions off to the corridor, I received a phone call from the local ABC television station. They wanted to shoot video of our move from the suburbs to the inner city and feature it on their 11 p.m. newscast. I wondered what the present corridor residents would think of such a spectacle. But it did exemplify the suburban white mentality of Detroit's broadcast community. For example, Detroit broadcast traffic reports announce to all if you're going downtown to use a particular route, etc., etc. Going rather than coming. A minor point, but an obvious suburban point of view. Most white suburban Detroiters seldom drove into the inner city. They never ventured closer than 8 Mile Road. Thousands of white Detroiters had escaped to the suburbs after the 1966 riots and would only return, if ever, to safe Greektown or the fortress-appearing Renaissance Center. Then they would say proudly, "Oh, we go downtown all the time." The moving van came on time, and after convincing the movers that, yes, we were actually moving to the Cass Corridor, we all headed off, minus the television crew. This was it. There was no turning back now. The commitment was made, and we now represented a minority statistic of those who actually moved back to Detroit's inner city, the only such move from suburban Farmington in more than 10 years. Once we arrived, the movers seemed to complete the unloading in record time. I couldn't help but notice all the attention we were receiving from our neighbors. At the time, I couldn't tell whether they were more interested in us or our possessions as they were carried from the truck to our house for all to see. As I handed the check over to the head mover, an Italian-American man in his early 50s, he looked me straight in the eyes and said, "What in the hell are you doing bringing a nice girl like that to a neighborhood like this?" "Anything else?" I snapped back. "It's your funeral, buddy, not mine," he said, as he turned and walked back to his truck where his fellow workers all glared at me as though I had just offended their sister. It was an attitude and treatment we would receive from most white suburban people who discovered we were corridor residents. It was definitely a racist attitude, because they were not just talking about crime in the inner city. They were coding their statements and camouflaging their white paranoia. We soon discovered that people did indeed live in the Cass Corridor, both black and white, hard-working people whose only crime was their economic station in life. Anyone's first night in a new home anywhere is usually an uneasy experience. I must say, however, that the first night in the corridor for me was as if I had come home. It was ironic that this, the toughest of all Detroit neighborhoods, would give me a feeling of security. Maybe it was the house itself, or possibly a feeling that I had reclaimed a part of my history. I'm not sure. But that first night, I had the distinct feeling that I had been here before. I was where I was supposed to be. I had come home. And that felt good. The next morning, we awakened to the sound of someone pounding on our back door. I pulled on some jeans and ran down the back servant's stairway to the kitchen. There at the door was smiling Morris Crispins. He watched patiently as I unlocked the 3 deadbolts, 2 chain locks, and decorative but protective iron gate. "You're not going to sleep away your first morning in the corridor, are you? Don't you have anything better to do?" I responded in a low, husky morning voice. Morris stared at me as if I had just spoken to him in Czechoslovakian. "Breakfast with your new neighbors, that's what," he responded. "Where is this neighborly gathering?" I asked. "Well, if it's not here, we're in trouble." Then he let out one of his Morris Crispin's laughs. "Well," I stammered, I'm sure we could find something in all these boxes." "No, no, no, no. We'll go to George's. Everyone goes to George's on Sunday. Come on, get Maggie. I've got to introduce you to everybody. I invited our bearded neighbor to come in and wait while I went back upstairs to announce our breakfast plans to Maggie. We hardly know this man, and now we're spending our first morning with him, she muttered, as I made some feeble attempt to explain that we shouldn't reject his first attempt to be friendly. She reluctantly complied. Morris insisted on driving to George's in his 20-year-old Chevrolet pickup. It was a retired Culligan water softener truck, but believe me, this vehicle had seen no soft times. As we drove to George's, Morris narrated the entire trip. That was the Purple Gang's warehouse over there. They were Jewish, you know. A lot of people think I'm a Jew, but I'm not. Did you think I was Jewish? Before I could respond, he went on with his tour. They did a lot of Capone's dirty work, you know. Besides running whiskey across the Detroit River from Canada, they killed for Capone. There are some people who believe that it was the Purple Gang that carried out the St. Valentine's Day massacre for Capone. Maggie smiled at me, knowing I knew that this wasn't true. The history of Chicago crime, especially Capone, had been a hobby of mine for years. In fact, I'd written a television documentary entitled The Landmarks Chicago Let Die. It explored all of Chicago's infamous gangster landmarks of the 20s and 30s, including the Clark Street Garage where the St. Valentine's Day Massacre took place. That was in 1929. The first Mayor Daley had stopped the project because he felt that it was a part of Chicago history not worth remembering. That's Mario's over there. It's an Italian restaurant that all the suburban people go to. Where is this George's? I inquired. Next to the Institute of Arts. In fact, there's the Institute of Arts, and here's George's. Morris pulled his massive old truck over to the curb and parked in a no parking zone. He then reached across both of us and pulled a parking ticket out of the glove box that was filled with scores of other tickets. Let's eat, he announced as he put the ticket under the truck's wiper blade. As soon as we entered George's, Morris began to parade us around from table to table, introducing us to the most ethnically diverse crowd of people I had ever seen in one room. Blacks, whites, Asians, Hispanics, you name it, and it was represented there that morning. Two or three really stood out, however. We met Larry Murphy, an Irish guy in his 40s with wavy gray hair, Popeye-sized arms, and a grip that left you grimacing in pain. I later found out that he spoke several languages fluently, acquired a couple of PhDs along the way, but had now chosen the railroad as a career. However, he spent most of his time writing. No one knew what he wrote, but in the corridor, if you said you were a writer, you were a writer, and you never had to prove it. When Morris turned to talk to someone else, Larry put his hand to his mouth and whispered, "You know, Morris is as crazy as a loon, but he's okay." Larry was divorced twice from Phoebe Murphy, a beautiful, full-figured black educator, who continued to live in the same house with Larry under a separate but equal arrangement. We also met Sylvia Stein, a suburban Jewish princess turned artist. Sylvia came to Wayne State University in the 60s to study and never left. I later bought some of her work, both good and bad, which I still own to this day. "Oh, you're the suburban people on Second Avenue," she exclaimed as she was introduced to us. "I looked at those places, but we're talking big fucking bucks, baby. Actually, I'm a neighbor of yours already. I live in the yellow cab behind the Reyes Brothers party store. It's not beautiful, but the rent's right. Right, Morris?" Then she slapped Morris on the back. Morris just smiled. "Hey, that bacon looks pretty good." She then reached over and picked up a strip of bacon off my plate and started chewing on it. "Put it on my tab," she said, laughing, and then moved on to another table. Morris turned and confided to us that Sylvia was as crazy as a loon, but he liked her. Well, so far, that was 2 out of 3, and I wasn't so sure about Larry. I soon learned that breakfast at George's was more social than anything. I can tell you it certainly wasn't the food that attracted these people. As we left, I sort of felt that Morris had publicly staked claim to us here at George's, a public show for all to see. I wasn't sure if that was good or bad. In fact, I wondered if we would be known as those friends of Crazy Morris or those suburban people on Second Avenue. As we walked out onto the sidewalk, a short man ran past us, and in pursuit was a second man shouting, "Drop it! Drop it!" As we turned to follow them visually, a third man stepped out of the alley directly in the path of the runner. "Get down," he shouted as he raised his revolver towards the runner and in our direction. We were in the direct line of fire. We all fell to the sidewalk as the man with the revolver shouted, "Freeze or you're a dead man." The man running tried to stop, but lost his footing and fell coming to a halt at the foot of the man taking aim. "If you don't want to be one dead son of a bitch, I wouldn't take another step," he shouted to the man lying at his feet. The second man had now caught up and was removing a pair of handcuffs from his back pocket. It was obvious by now that the two pursuing men in street clothes were policemen, and the man lying on the ground was their prey. They rolled the suspect over on his stomach, pulled his hands back one at a time, and cuffed them. It was a scene you've seen hundreds of times in movies, but never thought you'd actually witness in person. Both of the cops were in jeans and T-shirts, and I'm sure they were undercover. I was surprised by their language and how rough they treated their captive, but then again, this wasn't an everyday occurrence for us, and that would soon change. They picked the man off the sidewalk and deposited him in a police car that had now pulled up to the curb. After we got up and brushed ourselves off, Morris turned to us and said, "So, how'd you like breakfast?" Then he let go with that now infamous laugh, "Welcome to the corridor."